Welcome to the No Shortcuts podcast. I'm Edgel Groves. All right. My guest today is Eli Brueggemann. Eli is the musical director of Saturday Night Live. I'm really, really glad I got to talk to him. Our mutual friend Dylan Berry introduced us, and the discussion we have, I think, is really insightful. If you've ever wanted to know what it's like to sit down and write an original song or a medley with somebody like Bruno Mars, he's the guy to tell you. He works with the top comedians and actors in the world, and every Saturday has to churn out incredible music that fits into the skits and into the infrastructure of the show, and it's all done in a very tight time crunch. He also talks about how he got there, starting off as a jazz musician and touring, and giving really good advice, which was say yes to everything as a young musician, whether it's a gig or a session, just go do it all and learn. Anyway, really enjoyed this conversation. I think you're going to get a lot out of it. Without any further ado, Eli Brueggemann. Eli, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, good to be here. How you doing, Edge?
I'm doing really, really good. Are you located in New York City at the moment?
I'm located in Brooklyn, and we're under about a foot and a half of snow right now. It's getting crazy.
I know. I have some friends who just escaped that. They were trying to get out just in time. I think they did.
But yeah, well, it's beautiful for the first like 24 hours, and then it turns into, you know, the juice.
Have you gotten your snow boots on and made some snow angels and done the whole thing?
Hell no. I don't do that anymore, man. Winter number 10, over it.
Yeah, too old for that. You'll throw out your hip trying to do it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Every year I twist my back shoveling snow.
Nice. Yeah, well, that's why I left the East Coast. I'm happy to be in the West Coast, and I haven't really seen snow in years, which is, I'm okay with that.
Wow.
I'm okay with it. Yeah, man, so are you working remotely for all the SNL stuff, or do you actually still get to go in a couple of days a week?
I got to go in. It's a little bit strange because two people can't be in any one office anymore. So, it's kind of messed up our workflow a little bit. So I do most of my work from home, but when I have to record cast members, I have to go to the studio, and I can't do that remotely. Although we do have the technology through like these fancy Ethernet setups to do that. We haven't yet set that up, and it's better for me to be there to interface with the writers in real time, like when someone is recording. So we've been making it work.
Yeah. Digital sessions are absolutely brutal. I've got a lot of artists that have tried it out this year, and they're like, man, it's just not the same as being in the room, you know, that getting that magic and that one-on-one time.
Yeah. And remember, like, the people that I'm working with are not always like 100% comfortable in the studio. They're comedians that are having to sing. And so they need some, a little bit more handholding, some more coaching. The face-to-face is really important in getting the right result.
My gosh, that's gotta be a challenge. And then I imagine when you guys are actually doing the filming, there's all kinds of testing going on beforehand. You guys have everything set up on site and people doing that whole thing.
Well, the technical infrastructure is this monolithic thing. There's like a lot of people that work on keeping that stuff up to date in the studio. So like for us, we just, you know, we plug our laptops in and it just works. The show itself, when it's going, we've already done rehearsals, and like it's actually never really an issue. And it's live. That's the one thing that's the most nerve-wracking thing is when someone has to come in on a downbeat and they're doing it to a track. So the track's not gonna, the track is just being launched. And if they're singing along with the track, they have to come in exactly when they're supposed to come in. So that's the most, you know, nerve wracking part of my job, is making sure that everybody comes in when they're supposed to come in.
My God, that's terrifying. Just hearing that's terrifying, but it is what it is. That makes it fun.
Yeah. That's the adrenaline. That's what makes it's the danger that makes the job so exhilarating.
Yeah, man. I love it. Well, we have a common friend, I think, who actually introduced us. So Dylan Berry, who I think you've known a lot longer than I have, but he's a great guy. So
absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. He got me my start messing with the computers back in 2002, 2003, something like that.
Yeah. Messing with the computers, man. Yeah. I was just talking about that. Seeing Pro Tools for the first time in the late '90s was confusing and daunting, and I didn't understand how any of that would play into the real music industry. I just thought it was some sort of spaceship set up, and somebody's like, yeah, check this thing out. I'm like, what does that have to do with me making a record? But yeah, now look at it. It's all people use is the technology.
Yeah. I mean, we started out learning how to do stuff in the studio with bands and stuff with four tracks and then eight tracks. And then they had the digital workstations that had 16 tracks. And it was just way easier to do music that way, but it was a little bit more challenging to do punch-ins and stuff with that stuff. So you had to have your concept really together before you started recording. Whereas now, I open up my computer and be like, "Gee, what am I going to make today?" And like, I start writing it as I'm composing. I mean, that's not just me. I think that's everybody. But back in the day, it was like you had to write the song and like you had to sort of know where you were going, because to go over shit was so difficult with the software.
Yeah. And also, you know, before that with tape and stuff, you know, tape was expensive. You only got so many tapes. And you had to have somebody who was a technician who could actually cut the tape and knew how to, you know, not screw up a whole take. If you got a great take, but you had to cut one thing in, if somebody screwed that up, you're like, oh, no, the song is gone.
Yes.
Splicing it together. We're so lucky now. It's like the easiest thing in the world to make music. It really is.
But it has that caveat, which is that when you can change anything at the last moment, it you don't have to plan anymore like you used to. Like so the songwriting, I think, in some ways has suffered. Because, you know, especially in the rap hip hop thing, I've seen how these records are made. Like, I was talking to Mike Dean one time, who was on the show, and Kanye's record was supposed to be coming out like 2 days later. And I was talking about, I was like, oh, cool. So like everything is all like out the door. And he's like, man, Kanye hasn't even laid his vocals down yet. So like, it's this thing where like he lays his vocals down, it gets quickly mastered and then sent off. And that's the record. And so it's like it's not like half baked. I mean, I don't want to say that it's that, but like the craft of like really like looking over your songwriting and like making sure that this song is going to stand the test of time. It's just different. I'm not sure many artists are. They're more kind of in the moment these days than that old way.
I'll tell you what. I mean, that's why I look up to comedians in a lot of ways. You know, those guys walk on the stage and you've got to have your shit together if you want to make people laugh. And if you don't, you're going to bomb and you're going to learn the hard way. Musicians can fly in tracks live. Like these days, you can have your in-ear monitors, you can fly in tracks, you can lip sync, you can be covered up with all these things that make you sound amazing. A comedian cannot go out there and lip sync and pull it off and get a crowd to just laugh for 2 hours. So
yeah, it's truth. It's the truth.
Pretty amazing. Pretty amazing.
Yeah, our whole show is written on cue cards. It's everybody knows that. So like, there's no improv at all, unless there's a stand-up comedian doing his monologue. Then he's not reading cards. But all the sketches are all on cards. There's no improv going on. It's codified.
Right. There's no fly by night moment there. Well, dude, if you don't mind telling me how you actually got started and why you chose to get into this crazy business.
I mean, I fell in love with studying music. You know, I mean, I from a young age, when I was seven, starting to taking piano lessons, I didn't ever envision myself as being a professional musician. I just enjoyed doing it, and I played in my junior high school jazz band, and that opened me up to the idea of stepping out and soloing, which was a new thing for me. And then I started joining bands and learning how to be part of a rhythm section. But I never started music knowing that I was going to be professional. I was going to make a living doing it. It really, even until I was like 21, 22 years old, I was thinking about going into law school, going into like sports medicine. I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. And I had a couple people encourage me and tell me how great it was to the life of a professional musician. And I just kind of followed some open doors in my early 20s. And
who were those people? You don't
mind asking. One was my teacher. Her name was Joyce Collins. And she was like a jazz piano teacher that had always encouraged me since when I started taking lessons from her when I was about 15. There was another teacher that encouraged me to do it. His name was Bill Cunliffe, and Bill recommended me for this fellowship program called the Henry Mancini Institute.
Yep.
And, which was a really cool studio orchestra experience where you'd go and rehearse. You basically live the life of an LA studio musician for a month. So you go into like Sony recording studios and record something with some legendary artist, Joe Williams or like the Turtle Island String Quartet. And you'd have to learn that you learn this, you know, everybody in the orchestra could read and a lot of them could improvise and stuff. And so it was a amazing experience that gave me the confidence to be like, oh, I can do that. I have like all of the basic skill sets to do this. Why not follow this? And, you know, so I ended up getting my master's degree after that in jazz piano and arranging. And
yeah.
I think that without those two breaks, without those breaks that I got of some encouragement, I don't think I would have ever taken the leap.
Yeah,
I think all musicians have that in common.
No, for sure. I mean, there's those moments where the fork in the road comes up and you're like, okay, I can play an instrument. I like doing this, but should I go to school for medicine? Should I go be a lawyer? Because this isn't going to pay the bills. I mean,
no, there's no money in music. And now it's even worse.
Right. Now it's even scarier. Right. So, but there's that fork in the road where you go, you know what? I guess I'm just going to go for it. And sometimes you got to get a little bit lucky, but ultimately you put in the work early. And then when you get to that fork in the road, you're like, all right, fuck it. We're doing this. We're going to go for it.
Yeah.
But once you finished school, how did you, cause this is one for me, like I tried studying music, for a while and I'm self-taught. And once I got into studying it, cause I started self-taught the other way around, I actually didn't like it, personally. It just like, it messed with my head, but
yeah,
I'm sure you've heard that a lot. But how did you make the jump from, you know, having a degree in these things and really knowing music inside and out to having a career in it? Because I know a lot of people who are just unbelievably good with written music and they're incredible composers and musicians and producers, but trying to apply that to the real world and make a living doing that, like you just said, is almost impossible. Like,
yeah. I think you have to fake it till you make it. And it's just luck, man. Like you have to be lucky enough to find situations in which you're playing with people who are better than you. Mm. And as a young musician, the best advice that you can get is just to say yes to everything. You want to play a salsa gig? Yeah. Yeah. I'll go buy a book and figure out how to do it. You know, now with the internet, like you can know everything. There's
YouTube.
University of YouTube. So you just say yes to everything and you fake it till you make it. But I would stress like, falling in love with the work and not the expectation of the result is the importance of being a good musician. Like every musician, one thing every great musician has in common that I know is that they go into their studios and their rooms and they freaking nerd out on something that they didn't know before. And then they know it and they put that in their bag.
Yep.
So without the expectation of, you know, like, oh, now I'm going to get the call, you know, it's like I learned a bunch of like arrangements for some of my favorite jazz trios without the expectation of ever actually having to play those with anybody. But like, I just did it because I love to do it. And like having those now under my fingers and transcribing all those solos and stuff, the activity of doing that is what set me apart from other musicians.
Yeah, no, it's funny. It's for the love of the game, right? It's not for the outcome.
Yeah.
I was such a nerd for like progressive rock bands. Like I was so into like Rush and Yes and all that stuff early on. But only because I loved those bands and only because I loved just sitting in the basement or wherever I was and just learning how to play all those records by ear on guitar and drums and all that stuff. I found myself at 19 years old at SIR Studios in West Hollywood auditioning for Blue Man Group. And I'm like, how did I get here? Wait, you mean somebody might pay me to play drums? This is crazy. Why would I do that? But if you had told me, you know, even 10 years earlier that I was going to be in that situation, I would have said you're crazy. But to your point, that came up because I was doing it for the love of the game. I didn't have expectations. And then a friend of mine goes, "Hey, I was getting a haircut today, and the guy who came in is the casting director for Blue Man Group, and I told him about you." And he's going to be calling soon. And then he called, and then I sent him some demos of me playing drums. He's like, "Hey, you should audition for Blue Man Group." Next thing I know, I'm on an airplane to LA auditioning, and just, I don't know, crazy.
Did you do it?
So, funny enough, I got that first audition. It went incredibly well. I thought I flubbed it for sure. I was like, man, I bombed that. You know, there's so many better drummers that were there today than me. They're seasoned. I'm only 19. And I was like, all right. So I got back on the plane. And at the time I was living in Charlottesville, Virginia. So I left LA, came back to Charlottesville, and I was like waiting for that phone to ring for weeks. It didn't ring. And I was like, I didn't get the Blue Man gig. So in that time I started a band. It just so happened that I met the right people in Charlottesville, and we started this band, and we sent our demos around to some people. And one of these people was like, "Hey, I want to be your manager." This guy named Matthew Mays. He's like, "I want to manage you guys, also book you." And I was like, "Really? We have a booking agent and a manager now? What?" So in a matter of like just a couple of months, we had a full situation. We went and bought a van and we went out and hit the road. That year we ended up playing 250 plus shows in year one. Wow. He booked them all for us. And about 2 months, 3 months into that first tour, you know, we had made a demo EP and we're out touring, playing all these like clubs and bars on the East Coast. And I get a call. I get a voicemail from Anthony Sternick, the casting director for Blue Man Group. And he's like, "Hey, Edge, it's Anthony. You know, congrats. You got the gig." And it's like, "But before you can start, you know, we need you to come out and do a second audition in Vegas, but I'm pretty sure you got it. You know, we think you nailed it, and we want to put you in the Blue Man Group band." I wouldn't be a blue man with all the blue on, but anyway, long story short, when I got that voicemail, I was like, "I can't."
Yeah.
I've started a life with these people and we're out making money and we have a whole situation. Mm-hmm. If I were to walk out of that, I would screw them over. So it's really a strange situation, but it would have been a crazy setup. I would have lived in Vegas and played five nights a week with a salary.
Wow. Yeah. That kind of strikes at the core of the dilemma of the young musician. There's no roadmap or there's no manual on how to manage your own career. And there's so much entropy in the music world. Any talented musician in their 20s is going to have to make tough choices like that. I credit my wife in a lot of ways for helping me get through these situations, because I sort of had a tendency to follow the path that was most musically interesting to me, when that wasn't always the best career choice. And my wife would always be like, "Okay, so where is this thing that you're doing going? Like, what's the goal here?" And then we talk it out, you know. So she actually convinced me. She's like, in her early 20s, she's like, "Instead of going out on the road, wouldn't it make more sense to nail down, get a solid teaching gig somewhere and then have the flexibility to play gigs around town. And then if you need to go out of town for a gig or whatever, then you get a sub for your teaching gig. And that's what I did for like 10 years. I kind of dug my heels in LA. And I started teaching at this place called the Silver Lake Conservatory of Music, which was owned by my old neighbor Flea from the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Nice.
And I got the opportunity to teach some amazing people there. One of who was Dylan, who introduced me to electronic music. I taught Kesha piano. I taught Diplo piano. And another one of my big influences in terms of, you know, lighting the fire into my ass to get into the computer was Flying Lotus, Steve Ellison.
Yeah.
And through those relationships that I had teaching is like it opened me up to this whole other world of musical production. Just as the point when Logic was coming out with better software for interfacing with musicians like me. And I, you know, around 2008, 2009, I started really getting into production and like started doing film scoring and kind of came into that through the back end, not as a producer, but as a player.
Yeah.
But I would say that the choice to have like a solid income and a gig and commit to something, that's what sort of led me into this other aspect of my career. That's what I've been doing for the last 10 years now exclusively.
Man, that brings up a really good point. I've never thought of it that way in terms of that decision you have to make as a young musician, especially if you're talented and you have options. But so many of my friends went the route you went. They went for the solid income. They went for like, hey, I can teach over here. I can do voice lessons. There's this, even a club in town that's willing to pay me to do the cover gig here 5 nights a week, and I don't have to tour. I can be right here in town. I'm the house band. I'm steady. And I chose to be like, I'm going to go out there and play 200 dates a year, meet as many people as I can, try and build a fan base. And little did I know how daunting and almost impossible that is to build that from the ground up. And we did some amazing things, but in a way I'm jealous of people like yourself that you had somebody early on kind of whisper in your ear and be like, hey, why don't you do this? And
you know, yeah, there's, I mean, it's, everybody's different.
Yeah.
You know, everybody, I mean, I also got really lucky with my wife too, who's a really, really amazing person. And I would have been an idiot. I mean, I could have gone another direction, but I might've lost her, and you know, the living on the road is tough if it's not being done sort of on your own terms. Like if it's a sacrifice to be on the road.
Mm-hmm.
And I came up sort of more as more of like a jazz piano player. So like the road wasn't kind of like what the road would be for like a rock musician. You know, like I was like when I was on the road, I was playing like in concert halls or like jazz clubs.
Very different.
It's very different. Yeah, it's very different from like sort of the college tours that a lot of my friends did after we graduated. But like, you know, you drink a lot, you smoke a lot of weed, you have sex a lot with people. So that, I mean, that's a thing.
That's not the jazz musician's path.
Not really the jazz musician, at least not on the jazz, not on the level that I was playing.
Yeah. Yeah. The Dizzy Gillespies of the world are far gone, it sounds like.
Yeah, born 50 years too late.
For yeah. Sure. Yeah. Well, so you were on this path. What was the next like kind of phase that got you to this SNL thing? I mean, that just sounds like from an outsider's standpoint, that sounds like a very illogical jump, but also logical at the same time.
Yeah.
Like, some things had to line up, right?
The actual mechanical way I got the audition was through the guitar player at the time, Jared Scharf. I did a session in LA. A session and a gig with him, and he remembered me somehow, and he recommended me for the gig when they were having piano auditions for the pianist. So I came out using frequent flyer mileage to meet Lenny Pickett, And we just instantly connected. He's from Berkeley. I went to school in Berkeley, and we bonded about stories about Berkeley. And I toured with a band that his band Tower of Power toured with back in the 70s. This band called Mandrill. I think I just sort of happened to have like this hodgepodge of skills that was good for the musical director gig, which was not yet open at the time, but my predecessor was having some health problems, and so they switched music directors, and Lenny just mainlined me for the music director gig. I think a lot of people have the skills to do the job. But at the time I was a musical director for, a lot of like kind of cabaret style artists and like doing a lot of gigs in like these like supper clubs in New York. And he felt like that was a good background because a lot of what the musical director at SNL does is you have to be sort of like a, like follow the talent, kind of like you have to be an accompanist. You can't be like a superstar music producer who wants to write the next hit. Like you have to, it's more of a humble job. Like you might be writing a jingle 1 minute and then jumping into a hip hop beat another, and then, you know, dealing with technology and dealing with people.
That's a very specific skill set. You know, you're helping them. You're helping the talent get to where they need to go, but you need to have all the different genres and styles to back it up at the drop of a hat. You got to be able to say, "Oh, I'm going to be able to do this." If the guest is X, Y, or Z, I got to be able to follow them where they need to go and support them so they feel like their ideas can happen in the moment.
Here it is. So, like, the best advice anyone ever gave me when I started was Andy Samberg. I was like, "Any advice?" He's like, "Just do what we want." It's like, okay, cool, got it. And it makes it challenging. The most challenging part about it now for me is not the making the music part. Making the music has actually gotten a lot easier, even with the tools and like the software has gotten. I mean, if I need to make an orchestral thing, no problem. If I need to make a hip hop thing, no problem. But like 10 years ago, if you needed to make like an orchestral arrangement, it was the software and the samples were, you know, it was time consuming. Whereas now I have the tools to throw any style together, you know, if they want to switch it up, I can do it. So, yep. So now the challenge is in giving the performer the confidence to get the best, most funniest take out of them and like be an encouraging force, to the writers who are under a lot of stress. You know, their careers are on the line. If, you know, if something doesn't make the audience laugh, they can, you know, they can get fired.
Oh, I mean, I've recently just been hearing a lot of stories about how SNL truly works in terms of the deadlines and writing your own skits and hoping that yours makes the show and the battles that happen behind closed doors between the comedians. And I mean, it sounds brutal. It sounds like Roman warfare.
Yeah. Well, I think the theory is that great comedy doesn't get written by people who are comfortable.
There you go.
You know, there's always like an edge of like, of not unhappiness, but fear, like a little bit of fear. Like you really feel their vulnerability, and I don't envy them, but when they have some hits and when they rise to the occasion and everything on that show, it's really a beautiful thing to watch. And then they go off and they, you know, executive produce their own TV shows. And it's really amazing to see the transformation, the way that these writer kids grow up.
It's astounding. Honestly, I have a question. How important is it in your experience to not let your ability and your talent get in the way of your ego, like not letting your ego actually lead the way, but just knowing how to kind of push that down and have the abilities, but not let your ego, because so many people who are talented, they lead with ego. And I think that can be a career killer.
Yeah. First advice, I would say stay off the internet, because you can go on the internet at any time and see some kid that has like 10 times the chops that you do. I really have it's in the fusion world, especially like I get the enthusiasm people have for it, but like I've the older I get, the more I try to use less. You know, how do I really directly answer the question?
Yeah.
Because the older I get, the less I'm impressed by chops and right. by complexity, the more I'm impressed by simplicity and interesting collaboration. So for me, like working with comedians is different from working with musicians, but it's similar to being in a jazz situation, because everything that I do has to be supportive of the joke. Like what is our goal as an entity? Everybody from the guy who cleans the floors to the executive producer, Lorne Michaels, and everybody's goal should be to make the audience laugh.
Yeah.
If there's something that you're doing that's getting in the way of that, then you're fucking up. And it's the same thing as being on a bandstand in an improvisational setting. If what's the goal? The goal is to have a musical conversation with, you know, however many people are on the bandstand, and anything that you're doing that's getting in the way of that, you're fucking it up.
Yeah.
You know, if I play too many notes, if I play something that's out of context, that's wrong.
Right.
Coming up as with that mentality as a musician, I think is keeping centered in that humility and understanding that you're trying to do something bigger than yourself. That's kind of the key.
Man, that's words of the wise right there. Yeah, it's something bigger than you. It's not about chops. It's not about the thing. I'm probably butchering his name, but there is a jazz pianist, a Cuban jazz pianist that I've heard a few times, and I've just been shocked at how good he is. His name is, I think, Gonzalo
Rubalcaba.
Rubalcaba. Oh my God! Yeah. Anyway, this is off topic, but what a freak of nature! I've just, my God.
And he's control. what a perfect example of a player who came out of the gates firing like notes per minute. It was insane. He was this prodigy, and then I heard him on a Charlie Hayden record, the great jazz bass player. And he completely revamped his style. I think he moved to the United States, maybe stopped touring under his own name and started like actually hitting the ground working as a sideman. And he learned real quick to just take 95% of what he was doing out. And he became, I mean, he's on a whole other level now. He's so stark, his playing. It's not notey anymore.
Wow. I had no idea. So this,
yeah, it was an amazing transformation to see him go through.
Hey, you know what? That's what Pink Floyd taught me. Less is more. Nick Mason is a drummer. I was looking up to all these other drummers like Bill Bruford and all these ridiculous notes per minute guys. And then I heard Nick Mason play, and I thought, is this guy just lazy or what's going on here? And then I realized, no, he's letting the music do the talking. He's letting the space do the talking. And
yeah,
I think that's a metaphor for your career in general. I think, you know, leave the space, you know.
Yeah.
You don't have to try and shine all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And every collaboration is different. You know, it's like dancing with a different dance partner. You know, sometimes you just create that space for somebody to do their thing and then react off of it. And you get into this kind of back and forth reaction.
And thank God I don't dance. I'm a terrible dancer.
I'm the worst dancer too.
So are there, in your mind, are there any guests that challenged you the most that stand out? Is there a guest that you worked with that was like, wow, this is really challenging?
The most, I can't think of anything specific, but the most challenging thing is when the host of the show, like if they have to sing something and if they are rather confident in their abilities, yet what they're doing is not really working for either the comedy or if like it's just musically excruciating. That's a very challenging position to be in, because I can, you know, if it's a pre-tape, I can tune it and I can fix it. But if it's a live sketch and someone is singing live in front of the audience and they're singing like a whole other key and they don't even know it, and they're doing it rather confidently, like, that's for me. Sometimes I just have to bite my lip and just not say anything and maybe mention it to like a producer, because that's what producers play people like I play the keyboards. Like they know how to say the right thing to get to elicit the right response. So I need help with those are the most challenging situations, when something is not working and you can't like really tell it like it is, because a performer's confidence is the most important thing in front of a live audience. If you say something to them that makes them feel like they suck, the whole thing can just fall flat. I don't think that's ever happened with me, but but it happens in real subtle ways, you know, like you're talking about like little micro comments in the studio, like, you know, you can throw somebody off of their game very easily.
At one comment.
You can
deflate somebody with just one little comment, and all of a sudden they're not in it anymore. Their head's not there, and you can see the situation. Yeah. No, I was just curious if there was anybody who truly challenged you, but what about any things that truly stand out as just you had the most fun or fun stories?
Shit. I mean,
you got a million, right?
Yeah. Like, what season? I mean, we for the 40th anniversary show, we put together like a history of SNL musical sketches. And it was literally like everything. We did like a What's Up With That. We did King Tut. We did Marty and Bobby. I don't know if anyone remembers that. So we're Will Ferrell and Anna Gasteyer do like this ridiculous thing. Bill Murray was with Paul Schaefer. Like Maya did a Beyonce thing. Marty Short. It was like this like 10-minute thing that we did. That was crazy. That was really crazy putting together and really fun at the same time, because everybody knew what they were doing. It was like, you know, greatest hits.
Oh my God. And did each song lead into one another? Was it like
there were like transitions in between everything, and
wow.
It was really bananas. But like, that was one great memory. And another one was putting together Bruno Mars's monologue song, like my second year. It was a really great song that we wrote together. It was just Seth Meyers, I think, had the idea for the song, and he just gave us a couple ideas for what it could be. But me and Bruno sat in the room and kind of hashed the song out together, and that was really exciting for me.
And that guy's so talented, Bruno.
He can sing anything, man. It's ridiculous.
He makes it look easy. He's got an interesting story. I'd love to talk to him at some point. He couldn't get arrested in the major label scene. He was writing hits for other people, but nobody would give that guy a deal. There's that whole story on him. He went to every label 10 times over and they kept telling him no. And then once he had written a couple of hits that were undeniable for other people and he was topping the charts as a writer, people were like, oh, maybe there's something to this guy. And he got another shot, but it certainly was not overnight for him.
Yeah.
It's a tough ride.
Yeah, but I mean, you talk about somebody that is in love with the process. Like, he approaches everything that he does with such joy. Like it's not about like making money. It's about like what you know. It was cool collaborating with him, because his brain was so in the moment and so active, and you know, tons and tons of ideas. Like, you want this idea? No, cool. Like, it was just a flow. You know, there was never any sort of hesitancy.
Yeah, he's getting joy out of it. He's doing it right then because it matters. I think I saw a quote yesterday. It said, "Make art to make it. Don't make art to make it."
That was
really good. Yeah.
Very simple. Especially like anybody listening to this podcast, like don't expect to make it. Don't expect to make it as a recording artist. You know, do something and like do something with an instrument or with your voice that you can do, you know, for your mom or your dad or your brother or sister, and like impress them with what you do. And then, you know, record a video or something of you just doing it with like no software or anything like that. And just,
yeah,
just do something without any of the production.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. Strip it all down. A good song stands on its own. Talent stands on its own. Yeah. You know, I've always thought that fame, it was kind of seen as an occupational hazard if you're truly in it for the right reasons. It's like, if you get famous enough, it gets in the way of the thing you're supposed to be doing and that you love doing. It shouldn't be the thing you're after. If you're after the fame, I feel like that's just missing the point altogether.
Yeah. It's like, people want a story. They're like, what do you have to say? You know? And at my age, for a second, I was thinking about, you know, doing the artist thing and like doing writing, coming out, singing my own songs and shit. And at my age, I'm like, I don't feel now that I have anything to say necessarily that's compelling to a wide audience, but I still write songs.
Right.
And I still produce them. And, you know, maybe someday, you know, they'll come out with a record or whatever, but it's part of where my brain goes when I'm walking down the street or whatever. It's like, oh, there's a song. I'm like, oh, I think of a little hook.
Yep, there it is. I mean, you have to get it out. If it's in you, it's in you, right? Yeah. Well, last thing, because I know you got a really busy day. I know it is probably your off day, right? I think your Mondays are your off day.
Monday is my off day. Yeah, I got to go make another pot of coffee. And
nice. So I like to ask guests if there's anything in their career that stands out as like an embarrassing bonehead moment where just because you were young and you didn't know what you were doing, or maybe you just made a massive mistake with somebody, but it was a big learning lesson for you. Like, man, I did that, but God, it's still embarrassing to this day, but it was good for you.
Yeah. I had one of those tough decisions when I was a grad student. I was like in finals, I think. And I had like these juries that I was working really hard on. And I was writing a big band arrangement at the time, and it was just a really rough week at school. And at the time I was playing with Colin Hay from the band Men at Work.
Oh yeah.
I was like part of his like touring band. They're not like touring constantly, but I was able to balance school and his gig most of the time. And I got called like semi last minute for a gig. And I was like, no, I can't do it. I have too much school to do, schoolwork to do. And I got replaced basically because I couldn't commit. And I regret not doing it because when you're in school, the reason that you're in school is to give yourself opportunities to like that, you know. And I think I was more, at the time I was more sort of into like the idea of like impressing my teachers with without realizing that wasn't going to take me as far as like, you know, being on stage with this great songwriter. And so I kind of shot myself in the foot, and it made me realize, especially for gigs like that, where, you know, it's not the hardest gig in the world to play with a singer songwriter. Then there are too many people that can do what you do. So what people like Colin were looking for were people that have a certain level of commitment and passion for playing in their band. And I didn't demonstrate that.
Right.
And so he, you know, even though everything was fine, it's like all things being equal, it's like, well, I'm gonna choose the guy that commits to me.
Yeah, I'm gonna choose the guy who chooses to show up when I need it.
Yeah. Like, and also like showing up on time, you know, showing up not, you know, like high or whatever. Like those are some things that I did in my 20s that I regret, you know. Like those things are more important than how you play. Because someone who's hiring you isn't hiring you because you're a good pianist or a keyboardist. They're hiring you because you show up on time and you play the gig and you make them sound as good as they need to sound.
Yep. Yep.
Because they're under more pressure than you. They got to put the bums in the seats.
Yep. And you don't have to worry about their career for them. You just show up and you do
show
the gig
up on time.
You get paid.
Know yep. your shit. And I didn't really understand that aspect because I think young musicians tend to sort of be in their head, and I bet now it's even worse because you see all of these like wunderkinds on the lighting it up on the internet, and that becomes your North Star for your career. It's like, oh, let me shred and get like a million views watching me shred because that's like the pinnacle of a musician's career. No, doing a boring ass gig in an empty arena and showing up on time and doing your job year after year after year, that's what gives you a career in music.
Yep. I couldn't agree more. Well, Eli, thank you, man. Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, my pleasure, man. It's always nice to talk shop with folks, and hope people can enjoy listening to our conversation too.
Yeah, for sure. Well, let's stay in touch. And next time I'm in New York or you're out here, let's grab coffee or something like that.
That'll be wonderful, man. That'll be great.
Cool.
All right, Ed. All right, shout out to Dylan.
Yeah, you got it. Bye.
All right, man.